Today is Friday, August 28th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. U.S. President Donald Trump made his case for re-election to the country's highest office Thursday.
This election will decide whether we save the American dream or whether we allow a socialist agenda to demolish our cherished destiny.
Plus, Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe steps down.
Two recent hospital visits within a week sparked speculation as to whether he could stay in his job as prime minister until September next year.
And a Philippines staple goes dark. We'll have these stories and more next. U.S. President Donald Trump concluded the final night of the Republican National Convention with an acceptance speech delivered in front of about 1,500 people on the South Lawn of the White House.
In a new term as president, we will again build the greatest economy in history, quickly returning to full employment, soaring incomes, and record prosperity.
While the president spent some of his party nomination acceptance speech outlining his economic agenda for a second term, he took the political fight to his Democratic opponent, Joe Biden.
And this election will decide whether we will defend the American way of life or whether we will allow a radical movement to completely dismantle and destroy it. That won't happen.
But Democratic vice presidential candidate Kamala Harris countered in her own address.
Donald Trump has failed at the most basic and important job of a president of the United States. He failed to protect the American people.
With both national conventions concluded, November's general election is only 67 days away. I spoke with Villanova University political science professor Matthew Kerbel about how each party may try to shore up support during the next 2 months.
So the first thing I would point out is that we are really much closer to the election than 2 months, because early balloting is going to begin in a number of states in a couple of weeks. So by the time we get into mid-September, for instance, people will be voting for keeps in states like Michigan and Minnesota, states that matter to this election. So you're really looking at an accelerated calendar right now. And I think what the campaigns each need to do is going to be dictated by where they are now. And I think if you do look at the aggregate polling, you see a couple of things. I mean, one is turnout really is going to matter. And I think both campaigns are going to focus on turnout. They're going to focus on some of the questions that were raised, that have been raised in recent weeks with, for instance, what's going on with the post office. I think the question of election integrity and voter integrity is going to be key in the next couple of months. And, you know, in terms of issues, right, so for Democrats, I think the one thing that Democrats need to be careful to get ahead of is the question of unrest and social unrest. And it was a very clear theme during the RNC that the Trump campaign thinks that this works for them. And on the other side, what the Trump people are up against is the fact that the number one issue in this election, and it's not even close, is COVID-19. So they're running with a message that everything's fine. And the dilemma they face is that for millions of Americans, everything is not fine. For people who've been touched by this, for people who've lost someone, for people who've lost work, or for people whose businesses are suffering.
Historically, if you look back at previous elections, does civil unrest benefit either the incumbent or the challenger?
Well, you know, it's a great question, because typically, you know, historically, people have credited the Republican Party with being the party of law and order. And, you know, certainly that's been the case for much of the past several decades. Richard Nixon successfully ran on a law and order platform during a chaotic summer of 1968. But the difference is Nixon was the challenger. And so one of the strange things about the Republican convention was the way the messaging tried to conflate, you know, who's actually running things. You know, I think the Trump people believe that if they can blame the unrest on local Democrats, then they can claim that you need to reelect Donald Trump in order to take care of it, in order to manage it. But, you know, that's a much, much harder sell than what Nixon was selling in 1968.
Matthew Kerbel is a political science professor at Villanova University in the eastern U.S. state of Pennsylvania. The U.S. Capitol is the site of another March on Washington. 57 years after the historic March on Washington for Jobs and Freedom, during which Martin Luther King Jr. delivered his iconic speech.
I have a dream that my four little children will one day live in a nation where they will not be judged by the color of their skin, but by the content of their character. I have a dream today.
VOA spoke to some of those out marching on the National Mall today.
When you have an opportunity to participate, you should. Voting is the most important thing. This is what it's basically all about. You get the different gender of people you have here, and you get to see people come together, whatever their opinions are, but just to see people get unionized, this is what it's all about.
We came out today because this is an opportunity for unity to galvanize, get together, and just stand up for human rights.
Honestly, I want change. I want not only for us to have equality, but set up to have something more than we've had. And whatever little part that I can play in that, just to show there's numbers and there's a desire, I want to do that.
I'm outraged. And then Maryland State Police just shot somebody last night on traffic stop. When will this stop?
VOA's Jason Pentinkin is there.
There are just hundreds of people walking through the sun. It's a bit after 11 a.m. right now, heading towards the reflecting pool, which is this long, shallow pond that separates the Washington Monument and the Lincoln Memorial. And there are just hundreds and hundreds of people all around, coming from different directions, waiting to enter into the reflecting pool area to go to the Lincoln Memorial. Some have bullhorns and are chanting. There was a group of about 50 or 75 who were just now reading the names of people who have been killed or assaulted by police. As people enter, there's a station where there are free COVID-19 tests. Everyone is getting a temperature check. And only after the temperature check, and then everyone gets a face mask as well. The speeches started about 2 hours ago, and they are meant to continue well into the afternoon. There will be families of people killed by police, Breonna Taylor, George Floyd, and others. Martin Luther King Jr. III will speak, and other prominent leaders. And from there, the marches will continue after the speeches end. So really, I mean, right now, I was here a couple hours ago, and now it's just filled with people compared to them.
That was VOA's Jason Pentinkin speaking to us from the National Mall. And coming up later.
See, what I remember is that whenever there was a major issue in the world, people called the CDC before they called the World Health Organization, even though there was a very good working relationship between the CDC and WHO.
This is VOA News.
AP Showbiz Minute. The lawyer for R. Kelly says the singer was assaulted by a fellow detainee at the Metropolitan Correctional Center in Chicago, where he is awaiting trial on child pornography and other charges. Attorney Steve Greenberg said he learned of the attack on his client Wednesday. A spokesman for the Federal Bureau of Prisons wouldn't confirm or deny Greenberg's report of the attack. Keira Knightley has called for urgent action to tackle climate change in a short film produced by protest group Extinction Rebellion. The star voices the animated film called Climate Crisis and Why We Should Panic Now, and explains how carbon emissions are affecting the planet's ecosystem. In a statement, Knightley said, "Lending my voice to the most urgent issue of our time feels like the right way for me to take a stand." The Notting Hill Carnival is going virtual. This weekend's annual street celebration will take place behind closed doors for the first time in its 54-year history, with pre-recorded and live performances streaming online. This is Sam Golding with AP Showbiz Minute.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. Japanese Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, the longest-serving premier for that country, said on Friday that he was resigning. Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks has the details.
Japanese leader Shinzo Abe resigned on Friday over health issues that have grown worse. Abe is Japan's longest-serving prime minister and has for years battled ulcerative colitis, an inflammatory bowel disease. Two recent hospital visits within a week sparked speculation as to whether he could stay in his job as prime minister until September next year, when his term as leader of the Liberal Democracy Party ends. This is actually Abe's second term as prime minister. He resigned in 2007, citing health reasons, and after a year of scandals, then he returned in 2012. Abe's recently seen his support fall to one of the lowest levels of his nearly 8 years in office, under fire for his handling of the novel coronavirus pandemic and more scandals among party members. Abe's resignation will trigger a leadership race in the party, the winner of which must be formally elected in parliament.
Ryan Brooks reports for Reuters News. Chancellor Angela Merkel says Germany has a duty to do what it can to help get to the bottom of the apparent poisoning of Russian opposition leader Alexei Navalny. Navalny, an opposition politician and corruption investigator who is a longtime foe of President Vladimir Putin, has been at a Berlin hospital for nearly a week after falling ill on a flight back to Moscow from Siberia on August 20th. The hospital said earlier this week that tests on Navalny indicate he was poisoned. Israel has listed an El Al flight taking off on Monday for Abu Dhabi, which would be Israel's first commercial passenger flight to the United Arab Emirates after the two countries agreed to a U.S. brokered deal to normalize relations. The website of the Israel Airports Authority listed the flight on Friday, which U.S. officials earlier said will include an American delegation led by President Donald Trump's senior advisor and son-in-law, Jared Kushner. Private jets earlier flew between the two nations as their officials conducted covert talks. The historic deal delivered a key foreign policy victory to Trump as he seeks re-election. Anti-government protesters have tussled with police in the Thai capital as 15 of their leaders turned up at a police station to answer a summons linked to demonstrations denouncing the crackdown on the movement. The protesters are part of a student-led pro-democracy movement demanding new elections, constitutional amendments, and an end to the intimidation of critics. One protester hurled blue paint as others surged through barriers set up by police to control movement in the compound. There was no serious violence or new arrests. The almost daily protests are building into the most serious threat yet to Prime Minister Prayut Chan-o-Cha. As we enter the last weekend in August, the world has just short of 24.5 million confirmed cases of COVID-19, over 16 million recoveries, and 832,000 deaths, according to statistics compiled by Johns Hopkins University in the U.S. French President Emmanuel Macron is urging European neighbors to better coordinate cross-border virus restrictions as infections surge. Multiple countries have imposed tests or quarantines on visitors from France. Macron defended his government's push to restart the economy and its handling of the post-lockdown period. In Hong Kong, authorities are preparing for a start of a universal community testing program to detect as many cases of the coronavirus as possible. Hong Kong citizens can take part voluntarily, but the program has been controversial because medical experts doubted its efficacy and rumors spread of mainland China siphoning people's private data. During the novel coronavirus pandemic, which has taken the lives of more than 170,000 Americans, five former directors of the U.S. Centers for Disease Control have been asking, where is the CDC? The former directors say the CDC's response to the pandemic has fallen short and that its traditional lead role has been sidelined. VOA's Carol Person has that part of the story.
This is where CDC experts track every major outbreak in the world. They have helped stem the spread of Ebola, tracked the progression of a pandemic flu, partnered with the World Health Organization to end polio, and much more. Dr. David Satcher, one former director, says countries around the world look to the CDC for health information.
See, what I remember is that whenever there was a major issue in the world, people called the CDC before they called the World Health Organization. even though there was a very good working relationship between the CDC and WHO.
In dealing with the coronavirus pandemic, CDC critics say it has failed, that its first coronavirus test was tainted. Yet five former directors still in health leadership roles defend the agency, saying much was unknown at the beginning. Dr. Julie Gerberding is now a vice president at the pharmaceutical giant Merck.
What I would love to be able to do is to rewind the tape, because we do know some things for sure about this virus. We know it's incredibly transmissible, and we know that most people are still susceptible.
When Dr. Tom Frieden headed the CDC, he made several trips to West Africa during the Ebola crisis to see how the agency could help end the epidemic. He says with any new disease, the unknowns are far greater than what is known.
The more we learn, the more we know, the better we can control it.
Dr. Frieden heads a global health initiative called Resolve to Save Lives. All five doctors say it's time to put politics aside and pull together to end the crisis. Dr. David Satcher says there's no substitute for strong leadership.
Somebody needs to call attention to what we have to do together. And that's a level of leadership that for which there's no substitute. It's at the level of the president.
President Trump has been pushing for schools and businesses to reopen, even though the virus has not been contained. Dr. Richard Besser says it's a mistake to ignore or rewrite CDC guidelines.
If you have politicians saying that CDC guidance is a barrier to getting children back into school instead of the roadmap for doing it safely, the whole system breaks down.
Since the coronavirus broke out in the U.S., the information comes from the White House. The former CDC directors say the information is sometimes wrong, dangerous, or misleading.
Right, and then I see the disinfectant where it knocks it out in a minute. 1 minute, and is there a way we can do something like that by injection inside or almost a cleaning?
The president later said he was being sarcastic. After leaving the CDC, Dr. Jeffrey Copeland established the Global Health Institute at Emory University in Atlanta. He says everyone must work together to end this pandemic.
We need to feed truth back to the American public and to use those truths with our scientific evidence to control this disease.
Dr. Jeffrey Copeland says everyone must work together to end this pandemic.
If we could all just be pulling in the same direction, we would make considerable progress quickly.
A White House spokesman told VOA the administration and the CDC have been working together since the start of the pandemic, and that the president's highest priority is the health and safety of the American public. Carol Pearson, VOA News, Washington.
VOA has expanded pandemic coverage on our website. ABS-CBN had been the Philippines' largest broadcaster until its franchise license wasn't renewed in May, forcing it off terrestrial stations. The stations did appeal the decision to the courts and to the legislature, but they were unsuccessful. On Friday, the final broadcast of most of its regional news programs aired.
It's always been a relief to know that there is a regional news agency in the region. So I personally felt saddened when I learned the news that TV Patrol Regional will stop airing. As someone who lives in one of the poorest provinces of the country, I know for a fact that we need more national attention, especially on the current situation that we are facing now. There's pandemic, there's insurgency, we experience natural calamities and catastrophic events like typhoons and earthquakes. So it really breaks our heart that one of the sources of news and information is now gone, maybe forever.
Personally, I don't feel good about it, most especially for someone who lives in the province and access to the media and information is very hard. Knowing that the regional network group of ABS-CBN, especially that I follow the local TV patrol newscast, it's gonna be very hard in some ways because they provide very timely information.
That was Hermy Cabalas-Vasaya and Ramon Lopez speaking about the impact the loss of their regional newscast known as TV Patrol will have on their lives. The end of the broadcast also means that thousands of ABS-CBN employees are now without a job. I spoke with reporter Stanley Cajete in Manila after he walked through the newsrooms, now left vacant.
I can't imagine that ABS-CBN hallways, offices, newsroom is now empty. You know, I did not expect, because I was there also for many years. I became broadcast journalist for 8 years, and the hallways were filled with many people, busy people. Right now, it's very empty, and some colleagues, former colleagues in ABS-CBN News are now packing up their things. So I can't imagine that it reached this point, this day.
Now, with the closure of these offices and the ending of many of the TV Patrol news programs, what's going to happen to the journalists that were formerly employed? How many people are being affected by this?
Actually, out of the 11,000 employees of ABS-CBN, almost half of its 11,000 are now retrenched and now lose their jobs. Today, it's their last day, as based on the ABS-CBN management. Most of their contracts, most of their working duties ended right now.
We heard from some Filipinos about the importance that these regional news programs had in their lives. Now that ABS-CBN has ceased broadcasting the regional programs, they're only left with these online avenues. What can you tell us about the programming that ABS-CBN can continue to provide to the Philippines?
Right now, their presence is online, YouTube, and they are now maximizing their efforts to reach people through online. And they believe, even the ABS-CBN believes, that they will gain the reach and the attention of many Filipinos who are supporting ABS-CBN and now shifting from TV to online. And they will be, as they believe, they will be pioneering the online presence.
Stanley Cajete reports from the Philippines, and you've been listening to International Edition on The Voice of America. Until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington.
Next, an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.
President Ibrahim Boubacar Keita of Mali was arrested on August 18th in a military mutiny. The United States strongly condemns the mutiny in Mali, as we would condemn any forcible seizure of power, said Secretary of State Mike Pompeo in a statement. While it is reported that President Keita has been released to his home, it is feared that instability in Mali could empower extremists seeking to advance their Islamist agenda in Mali and in neighboring countries and lead to the displacement of millions of civilians. Indeed, after a military coup in Mali in 2012, Islamist rebels, some with ties to Al-Qaeda, seized control of large areas of northern Mali, including the ancient cultural capital of Timbuktu. In areas under the control of Islamic extremists, Malians were forced to follow a strict religious code, including forced marriages for women, until French forces helped the Malian military drive out the jihadists. But armed groups continue to threaten civilians in rural areas, and the violence has spread into the neighboring countries of Burkina Faso and Niger. According to press reports, more than 10,000 West Africans have died and over a million have fled their homes since 2012. U.S. Special Envoy for the Sahel region, Peter Pham, made clear in a post on Twitter, "The United States is not providing any training to the Malian armed forces at this time." He also tweeted that the U.S. opposes any extra constitutional change of government, whether by those on the streets or by the defense and security forces. The United States joins the Economic Community of West African States and African Union, as well as other international partners, in denouncing the mutiny in Mali. The freedom and safety of detained government officials and their families must be ensured, stressed Secretary Pompeo. The United States calls on all political and military actors to work toward a restoration of constitutional government. "We urge all stakeholders in Mali," said Secretary Pompeo, "to engage in peaceful dialogue, to respect Malians' rights to freedom of expression and peaceful assembly, and to reject violence."
That was an editorial reflecting the views of the United States government.